Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Cormac O'Hara. Are we eating our way to environmental catastrophe? And how credible is this government on climate change? Drop the backstop, says Boris and friends. How far will they get this week? And 100 years ago, the first Dáil declared no child shall suffer hunger or cold from lack of food, clothing or shelter. Why have we fallen so short? First the news, read by Paul O'Flynn. Thanks very much indeed, Paul. The no's have it. The no's have it, they say. Well, let's see later on in the programme what they'll do with that, the no's. But joining me today is a mixture of yeses and no's and everything in between. I hope it's Minister for European Affairs, Helen McEntee, Fine Gael TD for Meath East, Aengus O'Snoddy of Sinn Féin, spokesperson for Defence, Arts, Heritage and Gaeltacht, and a TD for Dublin South Central. Jed Nash is a Labour senator and a party spokesperson on employment and social protection. Michael McDool is an independent senator and former Taoiseach, Minister for Justice and Attorney General. And Karen Devine is lecturer in EU politics and international relations at Dublin City University. We'll get to Brexit later on, 51551. But what about the Lancet report on diet and its effect on the environment? The report calls, as you well know at this stage, for a dramatic reduction in the consumption of meat and dairy and a sharp increase in plant-based foods. Now, half a rasher a day and 1.5 eggs per week and cutting down on spuds. Are you up for it, I wonder, panel? Michael McDool, you seem like a hairy bacon man to me. Well,
I am sceptical about The Lancet, first of all, publishing an article which goes way beyond medicine and goes into kind of environmental and the future of the planet and all the rest of it.
Comprehensive study, though.
Yeah, but I mean, yes, but on the other hand, I just take the view that, I mean, you know, doctors aren't the people who know all about the future of the planet. There's a lot of other people who have to be involved.
Don't listen to the experts, is
no,
that
no,
what you're
sorry,
saying?
But I don't think doctors are expert. Medical doctors are expert on this matter. I mean, there's a whole lot of prognostications in that, and that is that a growing world population will all end up eating the same kind of food that we eat in 50 years' time. I don't think that that necessarily follows. The other thing is that I don't believe that current patterns of agricultural output and all the rest of it are necessarily fixed for all time. I think there will be changes. I think there'll be changes in changes in dietary preferences.
Over a period of time. That's what they're saying. If that's not good enough. That's not quick enough. That's what they're saying.
Yeah, but
here.
I mean, who are they to say that? I mean, they're a group of doctors writing in The Lancet. You know, I mean,
you're dismissing them. I
don't dismiss them. I completely agree with them. Now, I have to own up that I am a vegan. I've been a vegetarian my whole life, and I turned vegan a few years ago. But, I mean, there's so many reasons why we need to cut down on meat and dairy consumption, if not stop it altogether. And if you want to talk about health reasons, well, the World Health Organization has categorized processed meat as carcinogenic. And if you think of the people listening to the program and they're making the school lunch for their child, every day of the week, I mean, they don't pop two cigarettes into the lunchbox. But if you give the child a processed ham sandwich, that's the equivalent. Like one hot dog is the carcinogenic equivalent of five cigarettes. And so, the World Health Organization has also said that they have two categories. Category A is the science is definitive on it. So it's carcinogenic in terms of processed meat. But in terms of just red meat or fresh meat, unprocessed meat, that's in category B, where there is a high probability that it causes cancer. And you only need to look at, if you want to look at it, Dr. Michael Greger, G-R-E-G-R, he has a 2012 YouTube video where he looks at the top 15 leading causes of death in America. And if you take out suicide and automobile accidents, the other 13 are diseases that you can actually prevent.
Yeah, but can we come back to what we're actually discussing here? It's not that it causes cancer or not. It's actually that the method of meat production
it releases methane.
Propelling climate change.
That's correct. And also you're cutting down forests to create pasture that feeds animals, where you should actually be using that pasture to feed humans directly.
We have one person agreeing, one disagreeing. Minister, where do you stand on it?
Well, I mean, to me, this is about two things. If we're talking about food production, obviously it's about making sure we have a balanced and healthy diet. And I don't think anybody's suggesting we should go out and eat a steak every day and have eggs every morning for breakfast and everything else, nor are we suggesting that you should have a loaf of bread every day either. It's about balance, and it's about making sure that you have a varied and balanced diet. But also it's about how we produce our food. So whether it's in beef production, whether it's in how we produce food on our land, and we need to make sure that our carbon footprint is as low as possible. And when it comes to Ireland, we are actually one of the most efficient when it comes to our food production. What we need to do is actually improve that, because even if we talk about people in Ireland, say, reducing the amount of beef that they eat, we're an export country. There's a lot of people, millions of people around the world who aren't able to produce their own food, and we need to be able to step in that case.
We need to protect our market. There we go again. The mixed messaging from government, the mixed messaging from the Irish political establishment. Yes, listen to the experts in The Lancet, but hang on, keep eating red meat from Ireland. Isn't that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that we need to eat in moderation. So I'm not saying stop eating it. I'm not saying don't stop eating it. It's every person individual choice.
You're saying when it comes to Irish meat, everything in moderation, even moderation. That's what you're saying.
I'm saying it's up to every individual person as to what they want to eat. Until somebody comes out and tells us that you shouldn't eat meat at all, I'm going to continue eating meat. I'm certainly not a vegan or a vegetarian.
But I don't think that...
Are you not going to reduce meat consumption as proposed by the experts here?
Well, I don't think that I eat a whole pile of red meat as it currently is. I certainly have it as part of my diet.
You cut back to half a rasher a day.
I wouldn't eat a rasher a day, but anyway, at the same time, I'm going to continue eating meat in the same way that I currently do. But what we need to focus on is how we produce it. And we know, as I've said, that we are one of the most efficient countries in the world, particularly with our beef production. And there's a huge amount of work, particularly working with the experts who know how, in terms of our soil, how we produce that, and how, our overall
product comes to the shelves. Is that good enough, Jed Nash? We're efficient enough in how we produce meat.
We need to become more efficient.
It's all relative. We are relatively efficient, if you look at it comparatively. There are some very progressive farmers and producers in this country as well who are, I think, going above and beyond what we would expect them to do, at least legislatively and regulatory, in terms of how we produce food in this country. The food industry is extremely important. I mean, it employs about 8% agriculture and the agri-food business in general, but it is responsible for 30% of emissions. Now, when we look at climate change and the absolute existential threat that climate change involves, we can't just look, obviously, exclusively at food production and that kind of behaviour. We need to look at this, what we call a just transition. So how do we actually include people in modifying their behaviour in terms of the type of transitions that agriculture needs to make, that industry needs to make? And what we're not good at in this country, I think, is incentivising that. I mean, for example, we'll be discussing later on when we launch our recast democratic programme, the Labour Party's democratic programme, based on the principles that we established back in 1919 in terms of the document we wrote that was passed by the First All. But how we can actually do the just transition piece, it's not necessarily the case, and we can't just assume that it's always going to be the case that people will be worse off. You know, we're talking about carbon taxes and so on.
Well, yes, hang on a second.
Let me put on the lasso. We can't do that.
Let me put on the lasso and ask you what we're actually discussing here. This expert report, no matter what Michael McDougall is saying, let's call it an expert report. They are saying we need to cut meat consumption by as drastic as 90%, maybe. Now, is it the Labour Party position? Are you telling people now that if you get into government the next time, you will incentivise people in whatever way possible to move away from meat consumption?
I don't think anybody's talking here about additional taxes on meat. I mean, I read a fairly drastic statistic yesterday. I think it was in The Guardian that was talking about the potential for introducing enormous taxes on bacon and sausages and processed meat and so on. And I don't think that is feasible or that's realistic. I think we all have, to a degree, personal responsibility. I've modified my own behaviour over the last couple of years and I feel much better for it. I eat less meat. That was just a personal decision to take. I still have meat two, three times a week and enjoy it.
Looking into the middle distance, you seem to be craving a burger or something.
you won't probably see me reducing my meat intake. I might change which type of meat, but like I enjoy my food like many others, and there are changes need to happen. We've identified that in a whole range of areas to address climate change, but stopping Irish farmers from producing top quality beef in a sustainable way is not one of those. We have the EU at the moment negotiating to import into the EU 100,000 tonnes of beef from areas which have destroyed rainforests. And maybe we should start looking at those type of things.
But hang on a second. I can't believe the politicians are in a panel.
Well, I enjoy my food.
If you're not going to be a good example, you'll be a terrible warning, isn't that right?
With respect to your Cormac, this is an article published by a group of people in a medical journal. And it's starting to set how the whole world has to be put to rights by dietary change.
You can't dismiss it on that basis.
And we heard what you said. You don't want. You think that anybody who gives their child a ham sandwich or a burger is giving them the equivalent of five cigarettes. Yeah. I don't accept that.
It's scientific fact, Michael. You might not accept it, and you might not accept The Lancet and the experts there. But you should look at the science in terms of climatologists, environmentalists.
Hold on a second. Would you accept it from the WHO, who did say it's a carcinogen?
Sorry, that what is it? Red meat.
Red meat.
In certain circumstances.
Processed meat is a definite carcinogen.
But an awful lot of things that we do are dangerous to our health. An awful lot of things we do are dangerous to our health. But I don't believe that we should go around and close down the local Big Mac restaurant.
It's not about our health, it's about the health of the planet, though.
Sorry, but hold on a second. Who makes the decisions like this? Are these experts the people who make the decisions? What about freedom? What about individual
freedom?
Have
you looked at the climate change panel on this? The United Nations experts on climate change have said...
The Lancet is a well-respected journal, yet the Irish media alone are happy to ignore the research. Long live the Flat Earth group, says one texter. Andrew says, two inaccuracies totally already expressed on the show. The biggest loss of afforestation in the world is due to increased tillage of soya and such, and the biggest volume of emissions
which
of methane come from
animals.
The herds of wild ruminants, wildebeest and caribou, etc. I don't hear anyone advocating a cull of those species.
That's
as
nonsense. There's 50 billion animals killed a year, basically, for meat purposes, and there isn't 50 million caribou. I mean, that statement is a bit of a nonsense.
Isn't there another gross hypocrisy here, Minister Helen McEntee? Because people like... With all due respect to him, the Taoiseach says, I'm going to cut down on the amount of meat I eat. Yet he'll hop on an airplane a couple of times a week, head over to Brussels, and how much damage is that doing?
Well, if you look at what the Taoiseach was actually asked, and he responded and said, well, I've cut down on my meat consumption, but I mean, he said that based on his own diet, and he's entitled to do so. What he also said in the same sentence was that I do a lot of travelling, so I'm probably not the best person to ask. Yes, we do travel, and obviously, Jed has already outlined, agriculture is identified as one of the highest risks when it comes to our carbon emissions, but transport is second. So what we need to do, and this is from a government point of view, but also a European point of view, looking at our 2020 targets, which we're going to miss, there's no point in saying otherwise, but by 2030, what we need to do is actually reduce our carbon tax at the moment, which everybody pays, is €20 per tonne. That has to increase to €8 per tonne by 2030. Now, how do we do that, which actually doesn't cost people any money? And that's what we're doing at the moment as a government. That's why we have a cross-party committee chaired by Hildegard Nocton. That's why Richard Bruton is engaging with every single department to make sure that if people were asking them, say, to transition to electric cars, that we have enough electric points for them. If our farmers have been asked to move from green diesel to something else, that we have an alternative for them. So it doesn't cost people money, but we still keep in line with our targets. All of this discussion is happening now, but obviously has to happen.
We absolutely are laggards. I mean, that's as clear as the nose on our collective faces that we are laggards in terms of meeting our climate change and carbon emission targets. I'll give you just one example, a very practical example. You would have thought that there would be incentives for, you know, behavioural change in the bus industry, for example. I mean, I'm dealing with bus companies in my own constituency who are very anxious to try to change their fleets, and there are very few incentives to do that. I mean, I just read, I think it was in the Irish Times website last night, there's a very small fund in the Department of Transport that's underspent this year in terms of pilot projects for, you know, rural transport programs that would like to transition to electric vehicles. It's still more expensive in this country to buy an electric vehicle, notwithstanding the fact that there are €5,000 grants for each individual
car
purchase. So, you know, if you're put to the pin of your collar and you're saying, on balance, you know, I find it difficult to survive, I need a car, I have to buy a new car, my car's clapped out, it's 15 years old, you're going to buy the diesel guzzler, unfortunately. It's going to emit very dangerous emissions.
There's
an acknowledgement that we do need, you can't insist on people changing how they go about their daily lives, whether it's the fuel they use, the cars they drive, without actually offering another incentive. And as I said, that's why Richard Bruton is now engaging in a real significant way with every single department to try and address the concerns that Jez has just raised. But I don't think this should turn into an agricultural versus climate. Some of the biggest advocates of change in climate are actually coming from our agricultural sector, so we need to work together, and I think that's what we're going to be doing.
Farmers see it day in, day out.
They're the ones who are
immediately affected kind of when climate change or when the weather changes. They understand kind of the consequences. They're not refusing to change, but kind of it's, we're this very small island, kind of, we can have an influence, but we cannot kind of reverse climate change by ourselves alone. So there's a big job of work to be done kind of for us in Europe and elsewhere.
Based on the text, the listeners are underwhelmed. We fiddle as our Rome or Earth burns, says one texter. A texter says, this week the Lancet report was written by an interdisciplinary group of specialists.
Environmentalists, medical professionals.
Environmentalists, diet specialists, etc. Not just doctors, says Elizabeth. And a texter says, RTE should ban meat from its canteen. It might shut up O'Hara and Boucher Hayes, says Mick. It might shut up Boucher Hayes, all right. We never know about that. Look, we'll take a very quick break and we'll discuss Plan B. They have to come before Parliament in the Commons on Monday with Plan B. But what the hell is it going to be?
Email saturday at rte.ie. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
You're welcome back to the programme. Cormac, I wish these self-regarding right-on types would stop talking down our world-class beef industry, order a steak and be proud, says Ed. Well, let me give you one quick comment that came out of London or the UK yesterday evening. She can go back to Brussels, and she should go back to Brussels and say that the British House of Commons doesn't accept the democratic consequences of the arrangement you have imposed in the form of the backstop. It's got to come out. So says Boris Johnson in his latest rampage. Is he right? Is there any movement there?
Well, I mean, we're hearing a comment from somebody who is part of a government who at the moment don't know what they want. The UK voted to leave the European Union. The UK voted to put us all in this position where we're trying to negotiate the best possible outcome. We've spent 2 years negotiating that. We haven't been negotiating with ourselves, the 27 other countries. It has been with the UK, of which Boris Johnson is a member. We have come with the withdrawal agreement after those 2 years. Of course, we've seen last week a defeat of 230, a significant number. But I don't think it's specifically because of the Irish backstop. I think those who voted against it because it left the UK too closely tied to
that
the
deal
EU.
Is
for
dead.
Some, it left some
that deal
not
is dead,
tied
isn't
enough.
That right?
I don't think
deal.
So, no.
She got a deal. She argued valiantly for it, but the House of Commons killed it and killed it comprehensively. Now, that's not me talking. That's John Major.
Well, I mean, we've seen obviously a significant defeat, and obviously, again, as I've said, it's not just people who are opposed to the backstop. It was for many reasons, but we now need to see what will happen. We can't say that the deal that was negotiated over 2 years is dead when we still don't know what it is that the UK want. We have a vote which is going to take place on Monday. We have the Prime Minister who's due to come back with her Plan B. The likelihood is there will certainly be amendments to that, because I can't see her coming back with something people are happy with. Whatever happens after that, then obviously we need to take our lead from that. But the withdrawal agreement still stands. There's not going to be an amendment to it. There's not going to be a change to it.
Not according, Michael McDougall, to a former British Prime Minister, John Major. He was talking to Nick Robinson on the BBC this morning. Let's have a listen quickly to what he said about the withdrawal deal and about what could happen now.
So her deal is dead, and I don't honestly think that tinkering with it is going to make very much difference. And so the Prime Minister still needs a deal. If she can't deliver one that Parliament accepts, then she needs to become a facilitator. I personally would hope she would put down a series of motions so that members of Parliament can indicate their preference. We can then see whether there is a consensus in Parliament that is possible that Parliament would accept. Ideally for that, all party leaders would permit a free vote so that we can get an honest representation of Parliament.
Is that a runner?
I think that that's a sensible suggestion. I mean, quite clearly, there's a kind of a complete deadlock in British parliamentary politics. The right-wing ERG, European Research Group, Tories, have used the DUP to effectively hijack the Tory party and make it impossible for Theresa May to put through the agreement that she negotiated. She, on the other hand, and I'm very critical of her, she conducted the whole process in a manner which I think was seriously damaged by her imposing red lines here, there and everywhere, which drove her in a certain direction.
But if she
to appease those people and to keep them quiet while she negotiated, she brings back this deal, which they then use their opportunism and the opportunism of Corbyn to just simply vote down. And we're now in a situation that the House of Commons has to look at all the options, say, you know, and one thing I do think that would be very useful is a clear statement that no deal is off the table, that's gone. The second thing is that there has to be an extension, I think. The British government has to face up to the fact that it's not going to be able to deliver her deal by the 29th of March, and it needs time.
But if you are negotiating on the UK side, would it not be lunacy to remove no deal as a condition?
Well, I mean, that's what the ERG and the DUP actually believe, that you know, this is part of their bluff. They say they, and I mean, there's an interesting article today by Fintan O'Toole in the Irish Times that the right wing Tories believe that come the 29th of March or midnight on the 29th of March, the Germans will blink and just give in.
And they're also willing to go for a no deal if it came to it. Now, isn't that part of their power, though?
But that's part of their position, as long as the Tory party decides to keep one unified position on this issue. But what John Major was saying there, and I think it does make sense, is that there has to be a cross-party consensus in Parliament. They have to work out what do the majority believe in. And, I mean, given that it's a minority government and that the tail is being wagged at the moment by the DUP and the ERG in unison, there's nothing wrong with putting down a series of resolutions to set out basic principles for a negotiation and then go to Brussels and say, we need more time.
That seems to be what's happening. But let me ring in Karen Devine, because if that were to happen to come to fruition, that they go down the flanks, as it were, members of the Tory party and Labour party talk to each other and come to some kind of majority consensus. I mean, who would drive that then? I mean, the Prime Minister is out of the loop.
There is no majority consensus. I think it's ridiculous to say there is. There's Remainers, there's Leavers, and then there's those who are looking to use this as political opportunity. I think to delay it by extending Article 50 or to run a second referendum will be political suicide for both parties, for Conservatives and Labour. I think the only political group that would gain from it is UKIP. And UKIP have never done well in national...
A second referendum?
Yeah, UKIP will clean up in the next general election
would
if there's a second referendum. And I'll tell you why, though.
The issue once and for
all. It won't, because if you look at the research, which I've done, and even if you look at, say, there was a survey of 10,000 people who had voted to stay in 2016, but who are now going to vote to leave if there is a second referendum. And they were asked why. 40% of them said because it'll send a message to the EU because they were difficult with the UK negotiations. 33% were saying because I now know that the UK won't be isolated even if there is a Brexit, and they were mainly Londoners. And then 33%, I actually think that the UK would be better off economically. So I think the idea that you're going to have this turnaround, this switch, even to say 52% remain, 48% leave in a second referendum, is pie in the sky. And there's even been academic studies where they're saying that because there's going to be more 18-year-olds coming of age, and they looked at the characteristics of those who voted to remain. If you're young, if you're educated, for example. But what they didn't do is then rerun those models to look at the probability of them turning out to vote. And the probability is that they won't turn out to vote.
What do you think should happen?
So what I think should happen is that the UK Parliament needs to listen to its constituents. There's so many constituencies where there are Labour Party MPs where up to 70% voted to leave. They are obliged by democracy to abide by the referendum result,
to leave
the European Union.
What does that mean?
So you can either go by Theresa May's deal, which is an excellent deal. I think I completely disagree with Michael McDougall. I am in awe of what she has achieved. And I'm telling you, I don't agree with Tory politics. And I'm saying this.
I didn't criticise her deal.
You criticised her.
I criticised her
for
the manner in which she brought it.
And I'm allowed to disagree if I can make my point.
It doesn't matter what you or Michael think. It's the Commons. They're not in awe of it.
But the deal, well, they don't have a problem with keeping Theresa May in the position. But the deal is very good, because the deal actually does fulfil the things that Boris Johnson is saying it doesn't fulfil. He's saying you'll still be... Will you please not interrupt me? I want to make my point, Michael. So what the deal does is that it puts the UK into a GATT-WTO customs union, not a European Union customs union. So you are not actually subject to EU laws. There's going to be a group set up in which, if there's going to be disputes, if whatever the UK does comes in contradiction to EU law, there'll be a dispute mechanism, a resolution mechanism put in. But that deal perfectly delivers on Brexit. It is exactly what the people wanted.
Maybe it does, and maybe it
doesn't.
But they obviously think in the House of Commons it doesn't.
Or most of them probably never read it, though. But just like our politicians never read the Lisbon Treaty. Boris Johnson never read it.
Hang on a second. There is a school of thought now that there should be a people's vote or a second referendum, or that there should be a general election.
The Remainers say that.
There is also a school of thought that the European Union and Ireland have been too obstinate in their negotiation, that they hung too rigidly to the backstop, that they should have proceeded with the trading relationship part, which would have obviated the need for a backstop at all. I mean, do you have any sucker with that at all, Jed?
No, I think that would have been absolute suicide for Ireland. And based on what we have seen and the conduct of this debate in Parliament over the last few weeks, I think the importance of the backstop has become even clearer. You know, we simply can't trust the way in which British politics is organised at the moment to actually respect the wishes of Ireland and to protect the integrity of the Good Friday Agreement, and we absolutely need that backstop. And I think any sense that the Irish government might resile from that backstop, there would be hell to pay.
But if there was a good enough trading relationship negotiated quickly, surely we wouldn't need the backstop. Isn't that what they're
saying? But we don't know that that's the case. Ultimately, this is an insurance policy. That's all that it is. I think everybody around this table and everybody that we collectively represent wants to see close alignment with the single market, wants to see a customs union, wants to see all of those things where we can continue to benefit.
But isn't that the point?
From our relationship,
people in the UK side, why couldn't we have started the trading relationship negotiation a lot quicker and this whole thing about the backstop wouldn't be such an issue?
No, but you have to look at the fact that from the very beginning there were two very significant red lines put out by the UK government. We're leaving the single market, we're leaving the customs union. From an Irish point of view, how do you square that circle when you have Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK leaving the single market and the customs union without reintroduction of barriers, without affecting the Good Friday Agreement? For us, the best way to actually ensure that that doesn't happen is by making sure you have full alignment in areas linked to the single market and customs union, connected with the Good Friday Agreement and the all-island economy. This is where it comes from. So
but
when you have would,
but with respect,
from
you
the
will
very
be, you
beginning...
You will be singing that song as you waltz us over a cliff.
What are the other alternatives? What we know is that we need to have... So the withdrawal agreement essentially is the legal outline as to how the UK leave the European Union. That has to be there, whether we like it or not. So the UK saying, well, we don't want this. There has to be a withdrawal agreement because there has to be a legal framework which outlines how they leave. The backstop is part of it because of the red lines that they put in place. Now, as we've seen, the Taoiseach and all of us have been for the entire process saying if the UK were to change those red lines, if, for example, and, you know, again, going back to saying that we've been too hardlined, the idea that the backstop was not just Northern Ireland specific, but it was a whole of UK customs, that was actually a significant move for the rest of the EU. There was a lot of EU member states who didn't want that to happen, but that was a shift in the same way that there were shifts in the other direction. But if they were to move some of those red lines, then we would know going forward, having agreed the withdrawal agreement, that there would be significant other ways
They probably won't, although they're relying on the 11th hour, the 12th hour deal, last minute, Angus O'Sullivan, aren't they, on the Brexiteer Tory side. A texter says, what about the truck coming from Scotland? And he poses that question to you. So if there is no deal, what happens to the truck coming from Scotland into the six counties down towards Dublin or any other part of Ireland?
Shane Ross isn't even sure.
Stop. That's not surprising. Well, he is pretty sure.
Stop the pothole along the road. The difficulty is these have been negotiated. There is a backstop. That was the best case scenario that could be achieved. There's a lot better, probably, we would all wish for. Without it, it's no Brexit. Without it, we have chaos in the economy here in this country, in particular, and that's what we are really concerned about. We will have a border, not imposed by Britain, but imposed by Europe, by us, because of...
And if Sinn Féin were in government, would you be happy on the instruction of Brussels to erect that border?
No.
Would you do
obviously
it?
Obviously not.
Would you do it?
Obviously not. As a Republican Party, we wouldn't impose a border.
Would you accept the consequences from Europe then?
Because we have a Good Friday Agreement, which...
So let's say you're in power now, after whenever the next election is, and Brussels says to you, look, you will have to impose a border.
We wouldn't impose it. We would have to go back to the same negotiation we've had for the last number of years with Britain in terms of the customs borders and all of that, and we would have to come to that arrangement, and that would be within the IRC.
Surely the European model of doing business then, and free movement of goods and services and so on, we would suffer in that situation. Would you be happy to propose that?
We're already going to suffer, and we're going to suffer a lot more than people, I think, have imagined. If what seems to be occurring is going to occur at the end of March.
Would that be the right course of action?
I don't think most people have thought out exactly the full consequences.
But if there's zero tariffs and there's zero quotas on the products, which is what Britain is proposing, then you don't have to go through that.
There's different borders. So, you must remember there's different borders within Europe.
I understand that.
Just to do with customs.
But the UK is saying that it will have a zero quota, right, and zero tariff regime, in which case it is the free movement of goods.
And people.
That's it.
Well, hang on. We have senior politician from the CDU last night, I forget his name, but he said, of course, in a no-deal scenario, we would have to erect a border, and it would be on instruction from the European Union.
If there's no tariffs and there's no quotas?
But the problem with what you're saying there, unfortunately, is this, that you're saying that the deal that she negotiated is the only deal and will be implemented. That's what you're saying.
I didn't say that. Please don't put words into my mouth, Michael.
But that seems to be your supposition.
No, you're telling me now what seems to be my supposition. I stated it very clearly that the deal that Theresa May has negotiated is a superb Brexit deal because it delivers on what the people wanted and it allows free movement of goods.
But hold on a second. If we're with you on that, the House of Commons has rejected it by 2-1. Now, what is the way forward from this?
But they haven't rejected it because
Let me ask.
They've rejected it because of regional identity politics.
Let me ask you, Minister, what do you think is going to happen on Monday in terms of a Plan B?
So, I mean, there are a number of things, and I don't want to speculate or comment on, I suppose, what they should be doing, but obviously we know the Prime Minister has to come forward with her Plan B. The likelihood is, in its entirety, it won't be acceptable to all members of the Parliament based on the Dominic Greaves amendment before Christmas. We'll then see a number of proposed amendments being brought forward, again, based on conversations I've had. That can be anything from a motion of no confidence, again, either in the Prime Minister or the government, but we've seen where that would go. Another referendum, an extension of Article 50, a revocation of Article 50, go back to the UK or back to Europe. We have all of these. The problem is, as Karen has said already, we don't know if there is a consensus for any of those, and the only way that would happen is that if you see some of the other parties possibly changing views, opinions, as well as the Conservative. But again, it's speculation, and it's obviously up to them.
Finally, Catherine in Dublin says, I think Theresa May should go back to the people for another referendum to prove that the people want to leave the EU. If the result is not to leave, she will have saved face and can move on. And what about then the call for a third referendum? We'll see. Anyway, after the break, we'll mark 100 years since the first Dáil.
Text 51551. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
Theresa May should send the English Gogglebox panel to Brussels. They will sort it out in minutes, says Kevin. You couldn't just say, didn't she send the English Gogglebox panel to Brussels? But that's a joke, of course. Anyway, I'm with Helen McEntee, Minister for European Affairs, Angus O'Sullivan of Sinn Féin, Jed Nash of Labour, Michael McDougall, Independent Senator, and Karen Devine, Lecturer in EU Politics and International Relations at DCU. 100 years ago on Monday, the first Dáil came together, a bold and courageous move at the time, on the back of a very big victory for Sinn Féin in the 1918 election. Let me read to you the declaration made at that first Dáil. No child shall suffer hunger or cold from lack of food, clothing or shelter. By God, have we fallen far from the ideals, Karen Devine, of that first Dáil.
I agree. One of the things that I noticed when we commemorated 2016 was how the political establishment managed to kind of rewrite that history to suit their current agenda. I mean, Enda Kenny said on the 15th of February 2017, last year we commemorated the centenary of the Easter Rising and we recalled the achievements of the revolutionary generation. And he listed these as like solidarity and openness and tolerance, but he left out the core values of 1916. 2016, which was anti-imperialism, independence, a global patriotism and solidarity specifically with sort of decolonising nations similar to us or colonised nations.
But I wonder, was that really the motivating factor, Michael McDougall, at the First Stall, the coming together of the First Stall, to rid ourselves of the shackles of England more than building actually a republic of ideals?
Well, when you look at the actual circumstances in which the First Stall met, you know, only a minority or a small number of members actually turned up because a lot of them were Her Majesty's guests here and there, including Countess Markovic, for instance. But looking at the programme of the First Stall, I think it's true, as Jed has said, that this was a gesture by the Sinn Féin people to the Labour movement in Ireland, saying we haven't forgotten you, and it was effectively the Labour movement in Ireland crafted and drafted that democratic programme, and I think it was whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, that's a different matter. But it was a political deal by Sinn Féin with the left to say, we will look after you, and we don't want to divide on left-right issues. We want to establish an Irish state.
Do you know if Owen McNeill or Owen McNeill, did he agree with that proposition at the time?
Well, I mean, Owen McNeill was an antrim Catholic nationalist university professor. I don't think he would have been categorised as a socialist. And by the way, the great majority of the Sinn Féin members of the First Stall were not left of centre. They were conservative nationalists.
Would you agree with me, so Snoddy, that when they did come, that question I asked Michael McDougall, that it was actually to rid Ireland of the shackles of England, finally. Instead of actually coming together and saying, yes, we'll do that, but also this is actually the type of society we want. And many of our failures as a society in the country have emanated from that point.
Many emanate from partition, which came afterwards, which didn't allow those visions to be put in place. Many of the failures emanate from the fact that most of those who were revolutionary thinkers at the time, a lot of them were killed, kind of whether in 1916 or during the Civil War, and others were in exile. So we don't know. We ended up with, if you want, a rotten deal, in terms of what was within the democratic programme. And if you also look at the proclamation, it's many of the same sentiments. So you can't accuse the Republican leaders of just being bought over by the Labour Party in a deal kind of for the election.
But is it unfair to say that it's a victory of rhetoric over action then? Because
no, it's not a victory over, because most of their actions during the War of Independence in particular looked towards establishing courts, kind of which gave results which weren't always kind of in line with what went before. They were talking about education systems, they promoting the trade union movement, and the link between Sinn Féin and the Labour Party and the trade union movement at the time was very, very strong in most areas, and there was a very good production produced last year, the Atlas of the War of Independence. It's a huge document, and it clearly outlines the growth.
Was it not the genesis, Jed? Was it not the genesis, the very First Stall, of allowing a two-tier system in Ireland, in education and in housing and in health?
It absolutely was, and because, of course, the Labour Party made a fateful decision I think it was around about mid-1918, not to contest September. That election at a meeting of the Labour Party and the Congress of Trade Unions in Dublin. To the best of my recollection from the archives that I've seen and the recollections of that time, that about three quarters of delegates at that conference agreed that they wouldn't contest that election, because remember, that election was being contested on a first-past-the-post single-seat proposition. So you could have had Irish Parliamentary Party members or unionist members being elected to a parliament in Westminster when our ambition was to establish a parliament in Dublin. It is fair to say...
Should there not have been a Mullingar Accord then between Sinn Féin and Labour at the time?
It is fair to say, and Michael is right, I mean, the opportunity was provided to Tom Johnson, William O'Brien, Cathal O'Shannon and others who were involved with the leadership of the Labour Party and the trade union at the time to draft this very radical socialist agenda for economic and social progress in this country. And the line that you read out earlier on in relation to children and the rights of children in terms of food, food, shelter and housing is from the Democratic programme and not from the Declaration of Independence or the message to the Free Nations. That's a seminal document for the Labour Party, and we've actually recast that document and are launching it later on today to reflect those values and apply those values to today. One of the important things, and actually I'd mentioned this to your researcher yesterday, one of the core sentences in that particular document is as relevant today as it was in 1919, and we've actually retained that in all of its substance, and that is the subordination of private property to public good. We cannot deal with our housing crisis in this country if we continue to have the rights of property encapsulated in our constitution in the way that they are.
Minister, is that one way, I wonder, in which the ideals of the First Soil, that we've fallen short of that in 2019, 100 years on?
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody thinks we're living in a utopian society and that everything is perfect. We have a young generation in this country and we face many challenges that we're trying to overcome, but we've seen significant societal change at the same time in recent years. To me, if you go back to the First Dáil sitting, 1919, it was on the back of significant societal change from the year before, the Representation of Peoples Act. You had women for the first time, albeit they had to be 30, but obviously that's since evolved, being able to vote. You had men over the age of 21 who didn't own land. Again, that's evolved, but a significant change. You had those who were elected deciding to not take their seats in Westminster, set up their own government, which has allowed us since then to do the work that we have done. We have seen at the First Dáil one woman. We now have 35, 22%.
But
again, we still have significant amounts of work to do.
We're falling so short, aren't we? When you go back and read the declaration, the ideals of the people who constituted the First Dáil, I wonder if they were around today, would they look around and say, by God, this is not the republic that I had in mind.
I think it's a country that I'm proud to live in. It's a country that I think is a fantastic place for people to live, to grow up, to rear their families. Absolutely, it's not
perfect.
Absolutely, it's not perfect.
You know, how many people have to have their mothers or fathers or grannies or granddads on trolleys for days on end?
We had 20,000 houses built this year alone, and obviously there's a huge amount of focus. Housing and health is a key priority.
We have seen the Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, duopoly, the centre-right duopoly dominate Irish politics since the foundation of the state, since the First Dáil, I think because of that decision, fateful decision taken by the Labour Party, and that has had consequences for the broad left in this country since. We're probably unique in terms of Western European polities that we don't have that classic centre-right, social-democratic divide, and I think Irish society and the Irish economy has paid a price, and Irish politics has paid a price, I think, for that.
But like, you've been in on that duopoly yourself.
Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil don't believe in the power of the state to do really great things. And we do. And the idea that we can harness the state to deal with our housing crisis, harness the state for that just transition in terms of climate change.
In government, Labour Party shirked its responsibility to deliver for the Irish people in terms of housing, in terms of health. And it's not just in the last five years, in the last government. It was in governments before that. You
those
have turned your back
gross,
on working class. It isn't.
Charges.
You don't turn your back on the absolute fact, and in fact you got the message from the people in the last general election.
Let me throw a question. Firstly, in the teeth of an economic crisis, I don't know if Jed Nash can hear me at all. Can you hear me there?
Well, I can, but
yeah, can you stop talking for 1 second?
The guff coming from Shiv, which is very predictable, is unfortunate.
Let me ask you another question around the panel. Who here, it's not that it hasn't been declared in the First Dáil, I think it was 1949 that we were declared a republic. Who is happy in their skin as a republican?
Can I just make a point, a couple of points, because I was kind of cut off when I wanted to make a point. And that, like, you want to talk about those people in 1921. Arthur Griffith said, in relation to the Anglo-Irish Treaty, he said, it's the first treaty that admits the equality of Ireland, and we've brought back to Ireland her full rights and powers of fiscal control. Now, part of the problem that we're having here is that the 2011 government gave away our powers of fiscal control to the EU level, so that, such that the German Parliament got to see the Irish budget before Irish representatives did. No, because that was not... Yeah, exactly, because of the programme. Why were we in the programme? It wasn't to save the euro, and it wasn't because of the property bubble. It was to make sure that naked credit default swap traders like Goldman Sachs, financial institutions, didn't have to pay out on billions of bets they had made. That was the real reason. And then secondly, again, if you want to quote, and I think it was Jed mentioned the, the Free Nations, Ireland's address to the Free Nations made on the 21st of January 1919. It actually says the permanent peace of Europe cannot be secured by perpetuating military dominion for the profit of empire. And yet, our government is signing us up to PESCO, which is going to spend 37.5 billion euro of our money. We did not vote for PESCO because the government tried to obscure everything about European security defence that was in the Lisbon Treaty. And I wrote a series of articles in the Irish Times exposing that.
Okay, but can I bring it back to the question I ask? Are you happy in today's 2019, Michael McDougall, to call yourself a Republican with all that that connotes at the moment?
Yes, I am. And I believe very strongly in Republican values. And I believe across time and across centuries, the Republican ideal is one to which most Irish people naturally aspire. And I mean, republicanism, in my view, is a very clear view of the relationship between the citizen and the state, and also there is a guarantee of solidarity as between the citizens. I mean, genuine republicanism, you can't have kind of the Italian republics of the Renaissance period where, you know, families pretended to be in a republic but actually ran places as kingdom.
Has the term been stymied in any way by Irish history?
No, I don't think so. And I mean, I go back to...
But your republicanism and Angus wouldn't be the same,
I assume. Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think the differentiating line between myself and Angus is that he is a socialist.
He's older.
He's a socialist, and I'm not a socialist. And
that's the only difference.
I'm saying that if his concept of republicanism is a socialist concept of republicanism, mine isn't. But I mean, I think there's a kind of a tendency in Ireland to sort of mix up socialism and republicanism as one concept when they aren't in fact one concept.
Well, that was the core values of most of the 1916 volunteers, actually. Like James Connolly,
was an internationalist and an internationalist.
Exactly.
Well, how many people Angus O'Sullivan in 2019 Ireland? And 20 would recoil from calling themselves a Republican because it's media shorthand perhaps for the nationalist in the north who supports this strong arm force.
The Republicans in the north, that's...
Exactly, the nationalists who would go so far as to say, yes, I'm nationalist, I'm actually Republican, I would support, that's the shorthand, I would support violence in
Well, it's not a shorthand. Republicans in the north have voted for Sinn Féin and Sinn Féin's espousal of Republican principles. Republican principles which were espoused in the proclamation and in the three documents that were read on the Cead Dáil, the first day of the Cead Dáil, and espoused since. Kind of, there are differences, obviously. There's French republicanism, there's kind of very few around this table would kind of support kind of American republicanism as espoused by Trump.
Is there a difference?
There is Irish republicanism, and we've had our differences within Ireland in terms of how to achieve an end goal of setting up an Irish Republican, what that
this
means.
This is a question we get hung up on all the time, but is there a difference between those who supported violence in 1919 and those who supported violence more recently as Republicans?
I don't believe there is any difference between Republicans of today and Republicans of that era, because those who are now quoting the documents of the Cead Dáil, kind of if they read them properly, says the Irish Republic will be set up by whatever means
possible.
Necessary.
So no difference at all.
No, but can I make a point? Because the 1916 volunteers were actually putting limits as to the extent of violence that they were willing to go into in order to try to achieve their goals.
They specifically set limits.
Read James Connolly's last statement.
I have your point.
But I think we go back to this issue. Of course there's a difference between what happened in 1919 and what, say, for instance, the dissidents. Their view of history in Northern Ireland at the moment is, and it's this, that there has to be a democratic aspect to republicanism. Yeah. The state has to operate in accordance with the wishes of majority. The Civil War, sad as it was a war about whether an ideology or a majoritarian view would, at that stage, acquiesce in the terms of the treaty. And you go back to 1919, Cormac, and you ask, you know, is there a difference? Those people who assembled in the Mansion House were appealing internationally for recognition. They were appealing internationally for non-violence. They were demanding the right of the Irish people to self-determination and independence.
And
it was they were squashed by the British Empire at the time.
Okay, I think 60 seconds left. Such a significant thing happened that day where Irish men and one woman who were directly elected by the people who they asked for a vote, decided to set up their own parliament.
Yeah.
I mean, that was an extraordinary, I think, expression of self-determination of itself. They were deciding to go, not to go to another parliament, but to set up our own parliament, our own democratic institutions.
It was a really
in this
bold
state.
And courageous move.
Very bold, very courageous.
Helen McIndoe, to finish.
Well, I mean, to say that there isn't a difference between 1919 and the violence that we've seen in recent years, I wouldn't agree with that at all. And I think that no one political party has a majority or a monopoly over the use of the phrase of the word Republican. So I think to a lot of people it means a lot of different things.
Okay, look, that's where we'll leave it. Muichas Liber Fad, Minister Helen McIntyre, Ingus O'Sullivan, Jed Nash, Michael McDougall, agus Karen Devine, and Comora Sin Gialluin. Gudji, Giasarin Jogan, Yigahian, Slán, agus Bannacht.
Saturday with Cormac O'Hara was produced by Tom Donnelly. Research was by AB Film and Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan, and Tom Norton was on sound.